En este episodio de Unbranded, invitamos a Joe Pulisi, fundador de Content Marketing Institute, una de las principales organizaciones en educación y especialización de marketing de contenidos. Hablamos desde su experiencia sobre cómo hacer contenidos enfocados y efectivos que sirvan tanto a la audiencia como a los clientes.
What we want to do is not diversify so quickly and really focus on being great at one, maybe two outlets. But what you'll see is somebody creates an amazing email newsletter, an amazing podcast, an amazing, remarkable YouTube series, and that's how they first start, and then they diversify later.
Desmentimos algunos de los mitos más comunes del marketing de contenidos, con base en su experiencia como empresario y autor de bestsellers.
I don't care how many resources you have as an organization, you have limited what I call content energy. You only have so many things you could focus on at a time, but for some reason, brand managers and marketing managers feel that we absolutely have to be everywhere our customers are at online. And I said that back in 2007, when I wrote Get Content, Get Customers, I said we should be everywhere our customers are at online, and I was flat out wrong. You should not be everywhere your customers are at online if you're not going to do an absolutely amazing job in creating a content experience on that channel. Because if you're not, you're wasting your time.
Además, nos compartió algunos de los aprendizajes que a lo largo de su carrera como autor y empresario ha adquirido y que le permiten entender cómo crecer audiencias.
And this is where so many brands go wrong because, and I'll give you, here's a quick example. Just type cloud computing into your favorite search engine and see the results. And what you'll find is you have Salesforce and you have IBM and you have Oracle and you have a number of other companies, and they basically are all talking about the same thing in the same way. There's really no differentiation. There's no way that they're going to stand out. And that's what you see a lot going on in multiple industries where everybody's talking about the same thing in the same way. But what we need is we need a content tilt. We need to look at our area a little bit differently and figure out a way that we can differentiate so we can cut through all that clutter and actually have the ability to create an audience over time.
Unbranded, un espacio para compartir lo mejor del marketing y aprender de los expertos.
Hola a todos y bienvenidos a Unbranded, un podcast de marketing. El día de hoy vamos a estar hablando de content marketing. También estamos muy emocionados porque va a ser nuestro primer capítulo totalmente en inglés y vamos a estar hablando con Joe Pulisi, que es uno de los padres del content marketing, y ahora vamos a profundizar más. Yo soy Alejandro Geshberg.
Y yo soy Jerónimo Ávila y bienvenidos a Unbranded.
Ok, before everything started, I want to introduce Joe. So Joe is here with us. Joe Pulisi is an entrepreneur, speaker, author, podcaster. He's the founder of multiple startups, including the Content Marketing Institute, the leading content marketing educational resource for enterprise brands. Recognized as the fastest growing business media company by Inc. magazine in 2014 and 2015. Joe began using the term content marketing back in 2001, now the fastest growing internet marketing industry. He has spoken in more than 400 locations and more than 16 countries, advancing the practice of content marketing, delivering keynote speeches for events like CXCW, NAMM, Fortune Magazine, with General Motors, Nestlé, Oracle, DuPont, etc. And he's also a huge fan of the Cleveland Browns, which I'm glad that he's an NFL fan and he loves the sport. Thank you for being here, Joe. We're glad to have you here in Unbranded. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here. Yes, I'm. What the good news about the Cleveland Browns is I've been a season ticket holder for, I think, 15 years now, and finally they're halfway decent. So that's the good news. I'm looking forward to an interesting football season.
First of all, thank you for accepting the invite. For us, having you here is one of the most incredible chapter, because having you, we have had a chance of reading your books. And we know that back in the day, 2001, you were already talking about content marketing, which shows how you were very futuristic since the beginning. But we want to start the episode asking about something that blew our minds, which is talking about content marketing in 2001 with no social media like we know right now, with no outlets like we have right now. So you were very ahead of your age. Can you talk about content marketing back in the days, 2001, how this came to you? How could you be talking about this with not having what we know right now in our days?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. And the reason why I was talking about content marketing in 2001 was really out of desperation, but we can get to that story in a little bit. But basically, I come from the custom publishing industry. It was called custom media, custom content, that traditionally was the industry. It came out of the magazine industry. And if you were looking at a content marketing effort, it was generally around a print magazine. A company would send a print magazine generally for loyalty purposes, and they would send it to a group of their customers and hopefully to maintain or change a behavior over time. Now, when Google started to come around and you had social media there in the mid 2004, 5, 6, 7, where you started to have more channels with more pipes, I thought that this was going to be a thing and we were going to have to take it a lot more seriously. So the reason why I started fiddling around with the name and moving it from custom publishing to content marketing is I was selling to chief marketing officers. And if you go in and you sell to chief marketing officers and you call it publishing, they will fall asleep very quickly. They will not pay attention if you're calling it media or publishing or anything else. So just like calling it direct marketing, social media marketing, search engine marketing, we said, well, why are we calling this thing custom publishing or custom content? We need to call it content marketing. And I basically started to practice in sales calls and call it that. And even though the chief marketing officers I was talking to, they really didn't know what content marketing was, they were intrigued enough to sit up a little bit in their chair and say, oh yeah, we do content marketing. This is a thing. And then from that moment on, things really just took off because you had, as we were calling on large business-to-business companies at the time when I was working in traditional publishing, what we realized is that, oh my gosh, we've got, they want to get found, brands want to get found in search, brands want to say something relevant on social media, but they have all these channels and they don't know what to do. So we were saying, look, you have to figure out what your strategy is, who is your target audience. You need to send consistent information over time. You actually want to build a loyal audience and you want to change their behavior over time. That's the practice of content marketing. And here we are, you know, in 2021 talking about the same concepts. We've got more channels. We've got more different ways to produce content. We've got cheaper, more efficient ways, if you will. But the opportunity is that we have an opportunity to communicate directly with a group of people and to build loyalty so they know, like, and trust us. And 30 years ago, we weren't able to do that as well. And 20 years ago, we were doing it with print. And now we can do it literally on every channel. And because most companies still aren't patient and still don't deliver consistently, there's a lot of opportunity for those companies that do deliver consistently, that do have a different story to tell. And so it's probably, you know, it's funny, we've been talking about this for a long time, but it's probably the most exciting chapter of content marketing's existence, if you will, because of the fact that you don't have any middle layer. You can communicate directly with your audience, and that's something that wasn't really available 20 years ago.
Joe, you have this book, which is a bestseller, that is named Content Inc. Can you tell us a little bit about your Content Inc. model and what ideas you can share with us and with our podcast listeners of the most powerful learnings about content marketing in those 20 years? And I think your book has many of these insights. Can you give us like a quick review about it?
Sure. Thank you. I'd be happy to. I wrote Content Inc. came out first, in the first version in 2015. And what I was trying to understand, I was looking at a number of content creators and how they were building audiences with little to no money and little to no resources. And I was wondering if we could reconstruct their model and learn something from their journey. And what we were able to do is we came up with the initial Content Inc. model, and it talked about the different steps. And then just recently updated that in 2021, hundreds of case studies all around the globe. And we found a 7-step model. And that there really is a way to go to market, to build a loyal audience and then drive revenue from that audience. But most companies don't do that right. So a couple of the key learnings, I'm not going to go through every step because I think it's unnecessary, but the couple steps that are really interesting that we found is that most businesses diversify too quickly, or they diversify immediately. So if you look at the best content marketing examples, like a Red Bull Media House, if you will, or the best media examples in the world, like a New York Times Magazine, they start by delivering in one channel, in one content type, and they do that over a long period of time. That is something that most brands don't do. Most brands are dabbling in every channel. They see a new social media outlet and they become infatuated with it, and they've got to run to it, and they've got to create content. We need a whole team around it. But if you want to build a loyal audience over time, we only have so much content energy in an organization. So what we want to do is we want to become great and exceptional at one thing. So that's what we want to do, is not diversify so quickly and really focus on being great at one, maybe two outlets. But what you'll see is somebody creates an amazing email newsletter, an amazing podcast, an amazing, remarkable YouTube series. And that's how they first start. And then they diversify later. And so what you want to do is you want to focus on one thing and diversify later. The second thing is, if you're going to do it, you've got to deliver consistently. Content creation and distribution, that's a promise to your customers. You actually have to deliver value consistently over a long period of time. And then the third thing we talk about, this is the second step of the model. It's called the content tilt. And this is where so many brands go wrong because, and I'll give you, here's a quick example. Just type cloud computing into your favorite search engine and see the results. And what you'll find is you have Salesforce and you have IBM and you have Oracle and you have a number of other companies, and they basically are all talking about the same thing in the same way. There's really no differentiation. There's no way that they're going to stand out. And that's what you see a lot going on in multiple industries, where everybody's talking about the same thing in the same way. But what we need is we need a content tilt. We need to look at our area a little bit differently and figure out a way that we can differentiate so we can cut through all that clutter and actually have the ability to create an audience over time. So we have to find a new platform. We have to focus on a more niche audience. We have to talk about something differently than anyone else has talked about. For example, I mean, I called it content marketing when everyone else was calling it custom publishing. Not rocket science, just called it something different. Marketing automation company, HubSpot, used that with inbound marketing. You know, they just said, oh, we're going to name it inbound marketing. They put a lot of resources to it. And then, of course, now they're now a $30 billion market cap company. Who knew that was going to happen? So that's sort of the model. But what I love about it is it's fairly predictable. If you build an audience, it takes you about 9 to 15 months to build that first audience on that one platform. Once you build that audience, then you can start to diversify into other areas. So if you have a podcast, you might then launch a video series, whatnot. Then you start to drive revenue from that at about the 18-month mark or so, significant revenue. And then once you get to 24 to 36 months, you have a really good opportunity to be the leading expert in your niche. And if you become the leading expert in your niche, then you have all kinds of opportunities to sell whatever you want to, because if you know the customer better than anyone else and you know your audience, then you're able to create all kinds of new revenue opportunities.
I have a lot of questions about the model, but let's start with the beginning. We know you're a huge believer helping people to define their goals and how to achieve them. Can you share us a little bit about this concept of recording all your objectives and having like a review, daily review, and how that discipline helps you out to achieve those objectives in time? Because I think this applies personally, but also this applies a lot in marketing professionals, because everything is now about results. No, in marketing, like having these KPIs really clear, and with all this cool technology that helps us out to measure almost in real time, in a more precise way than ever, what's working and what's not working, and this all this A/B mindset of test and fail and learn fast. So how this define and record your goals in time has been part of your life and success in this model of content marketing?
Sure, happy to. Yeah, there's a. I mean, I've read a few books, Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, any book by Stephen Covey, Grant Cardone, 10X Rule, and I've sort of come up with this record, repeat, remove. Format. And I believe that if you're a marketer, you should be doing this with your team. And if you're an individual, you should absolutely do it. So there's, and I started doing this in 2008 and it completely changed my life. So if you were asking me, what's the one thing that I've done that's probably different than most people that has led to the biggest advantage, it's absolutely this goal setting process. So the first thing you want to do is you want to record your goals and not just financial or career goals. You want to write down a goal, a financial, career, spiritual, mental, physical, family, philanthropic, those goals. And you want to set one or two goals under each one that's absolutely measurable. And so that's what I ended up doing. Like, for example, we talk about this in the book. My wife and I own Content Marketing Institute. And in 2008, we set the goal to sell for $15 million US dollars in 2015, which is crazy when you think about it, because in 2008, we were losing money and we didn't have much of an audience at all. But every day I would get up and I would review that goal that we'd sell in 2015 for that amount of money. And then before I went to sleep at the end of the day, I would review that as well. And it's amazing when you review these goals over and over again, how they change you. And you do things differently during the day. So you want to go ahead and record that, and then you repeat it during the day, in the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. And then what you want to do is look out in front of you and you want to remove any obstacles in your way. So let's just say that let's go back to our content marketing conversation, right? If you want to create the greatest email newsletter in your industry to your target niche, but you're wasting your time in a Facebook group that's not additive in any way to your customers, to your audience, or to the company, maybe you should remove that so that you can focus on being great at this email newsletter. Or let's just say personally, let's say you're not as productive as you want to be. Well, maybe you should stop watching television for 3 hours, or you should not be on Twitter for 2 hours during the day. That's unproductive. Those are the types of things we look for. But how do you know unless you review those goals on a regular basis? So I'm a big, big believer in that. And I'll just add one more thing because I think it's important to the conversation. When we talked about the content tilt in your differentiation area, we also want to create something called the content mission statement. And that's another thing that you want to review, because what you want to do is you want to put this in front of your marketing team and you want to say, why are we creating all this content? Who are we creating it for? Who's the audience? What are we telling them? What's our story we're sending them? And then what's the outcome for the audience? How are we helping them live a better life or get a better job in some way? You actually write that down. And every time before you have a content meeting, you should be reviewing that with your team so that everyone knows why we're creating content. Because what you'll find is you have new people coming in and out, or you haven't talked about it for a while. You may not understand that our first and foremost goal, and I know this is tough to say, is not to sell more product. What we're trying to do is make a positive impact on our audience. And if we do that and they know, like, and trust us, then we'll be able to sell them multiple things. But you can't sell before you build that audience. So anyways, that whole goal setting, record, remove, repeat process, very important. And I think any marketer, any human being needs to have something that gets them through the day like that.
There's something that you do amazingly, and I have been reading about you and talking about you with Fernando and a lot of people who knows you. And I think something that amazed me is how you were able to bring a lot of these ideas from the personal perspective of what you need to do as a human, but will also be as good and it will bring results also in the marketing area and in the marketing day-to-day business. And as you were saying, there's something that I love about the goals. When you try to hit a huge goal, it's very important for you to understand what's the small goals that will take you to that goal, but always talking about the same goal, you know? So I imagine when you were trying to figure out where you're going to be ready to sell, you were having in your mind that every day you will be working towards that result, but you will have checkpoints of 1 day or 2 days or 1 week that will take you there, because it's not just like a jump. It's like a small process. But I think something that I'm very aligned with you is that you need to always think about which is that result that you're looking forward and what you need to do to make sure that this is going to be the end game of the whole journey. But as a brand, because as an individual, it's kind of like easier because you need to control your environment and it's about you, your couple, your family. But when we bring these ideas as a brand, what do you think about how to keep focus have a decision and a prioritized plan when we live in an era where there are thousands of channels, right? And you were talking about deciding where do you want to put 100% of your mind and on your plan, but we live in a world where you as a brand have a lot of niches or a lot of touch points, right? And if you work in a huge brand, you will be asked to be in TikTok, but also in Twitch, but also in Clubhouse, and not leaving Facebook away or Instagram. But what about having a collaboration in Netflix, Hulu, whatever, in terms of product placement or brand integration? So when you bring these ideas that you just shared with us to a brand, how do you manage to focus on what you need to do when there's going to be a lot of vibes pushing you to go and be ready to be in a multi-channel industry perspective?
So it's a great question. And I probably have a different take than most, because when I'll go in and do, and I've done many, many over the years, and we'll look at a content audit or a social media audit and look at what a larger brand's doing. And basically what happens is they're not seeing any results in so many channels. And what I want to go back is I want to say, why are you in that channel? Why are you on Twitch? Why are you doing this integration over here? I'm not saying it's wrong. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be in those places. But generally, when we go in and we'll do something and we'll try to get a baseline for what's going on in the organization, there's so much activity and there's so many different moving parts, you can't be great at anything. At best, you're mediocre at a whole bunch of different things. And so I'm trying to go in and I'm saying, okay, yes, I know you feel you need to be on Twitch. I know you feel you need to be on Clubhouse. I know you think you should have some kind of TikTok effort, but I'm going to question that because I don't know if you should, because is it better that you're just there? Do you just need to be there every once in a while and have people see you have some kind of post in there? Or wouldn't it be better if you could build some amazing loyal audience through a podcast that completely changes the face of your industry? Wouldn't that be more, and I'm not saying that's it, but I'm using it as an example. Maybe that's something we should do. Now, the thing is that I don't care how many resources you have as an organization, you have limited what I call content energy. You only have so many things you could focus on at a time. But for some reason, brand managers and marketing managers feel that we absolutely have to be everywhere our customers are at online. And I said that back in 2007 when I wrote Get Content, Get Customers. I said we should be everywhere our customers are at online, and I was flat out wrong. You should not be everywhere your customers are at online if you're not going to do an absolutely amazing job in creating a content experience on that channel. Because if you're not, you're wasting your time. You just want to be part of, it's not going to do anything for your audience. So that's what we want to do, is instead of creating what my friend Doug Kessler says, a mountain of meh content everywhere, let's focus on, back to the goal setting, let's focus on one, two, or three places we can be exceptional and truly impact the lives and the jobs of our customers. And maybe those other channels, maybe we should just be listening. Maybe we should just use them as customer service tools. Or maybe we don't have to have an actual content effort in those areas. Now, if you go and accomplish the most amazing podcast and you become a Red Bull Media House, great. You can go into all these other channels and do what you need to do. But I just frankly, Alejandro, I just see a lot of wasting of time that people are, and when you're wasting time, you're wasting your audience's time. And that's why in a lot of cases, I think you're just seeing a ton of turnover on the marketing side and the brand side, because there's no focus. And by the way, I'm not taking this lightly. This is a very tough decision to make. If you are a brand person, marketing person, and you go in an organization and you're going to say, maybe we shouldn't be on TikTok, when the chief executive officer or the chief marketing officer thinks you should, you got a problem there. And that's why right off the bat, before you take a job or if you need to level set, you should figure out who has certain priorities. Because if the chief marketing officer falls in love with Clubhouse, I need to know why. Do you think it's the next greatest thing? Did you see some data that I didn't see? Do you think that our brand is best suited to create an audience on that platform? I need to know what those things are, what I'm getting myself into, if I'm going to execute successfully. Because then you got to come back to the data. The data says that that kind of a strategy is almost, in almost all cases, a lose-lose scenario. You're going to lose as a brand, and your customers are going to lose because you're not adding any value. So I'd rather focus my attention on the things that I can say, yes, we can be the leading expert in the world to this audience on this thing. That's one audience. And then maybe another audience, you say, no, for that one, we can be the leading expert over here and do this amazing podcast or amazing email newsletter. So in this case, less is more. Very, very hard to do. I'm not saying it's not. It's almost impossible in a lot of these large companies. But I think in a lot of cases, they're just wasting their time.
I totally agree. And we see this a lot in the market, because there's like this fear of missing out, this new opportunity, or be like the first brand in the category to achieve the opportunity and be the first mover, the one who is always doing innovation. But I also see it as a trap, because as you already said, it needs to be more about data and having the proof that we need to be there in order to achieve our goals. And this gets us back in this that you were saying, that if you have a clear goal you want to achieve and you record a daily basis or a weekly basis how you are advancing in those tasks that will get you there, and you are learning from what works and what does not work to achieve those goals, then the data will help you out to set those priorities. And also, for me, it's very important to learn to say no to this new platform that we don't know if it's going to help us or not, and probably just a new hype that will be passing along as many other things that happened in the internet, in platforms in the last 20 years. But it's also about resources and not just money. I talk with many marketing teams, and this is a common symptom that I see out there, and with the pandemic has just get worse, which is this burnout, because there's so much things to do in digital. It's overwhelming. The options, that unlimited options that we have in the internet and in digital ecosystems, that we don't have the resources in terms of hands in marketing teams to be specialized in CRM, in media buying, in social media, content production, et cetera. And it's more about energy than resources, no? As you already said, because we don't have like the focus to just do correctly a few things rather than mediocre a lot of things. Moving along into the return on investment, I think there are like two approaches here. Like, if you are a content creator, it's more about generating revenue. And if you are a brand, it's probably more about being relevant, no? But just for a start, let's just focus on the revenue part of it. If you can tell us like this general model that you have about revenue, because I think it's like the most common question in content creators that I know a lot about this topic. I have this tilt or differentiator in how I talk about this subject. I built this huge audience in YouTube, in social media, like Twitter, etc. But now how I make money from this, and also this is the new, like, cool job to be like an influencer for many young people, no? And they think it's easy, and it's not easy. It is quite a complex and competitive landscape that changes very dynamically. And in general, what are these options? And in specific, I would like to hear your thoughts about this subscription model, which is a new hype and in many content creators, especially in podcast industry, with these announces in Spotify and Apple Podcast of this new revenue subscription model that they are trying to figure out, which is had been for a few years now, started with these traditional media companies as New York Times that has this written a blog or website, and most people now pay a subscription for that content. But in podcast has been one of the few revenue streams that seems to been working for some podcasters.
Well, so let's talk about the model really quickly, because when I talk to a marketer about the business model of content creation, I'm saying the same thing that I would to a media professional, because if we're talking about true content marketing, and true content marketing is not just I'm using content in marketing. What I'm trying to do in content marketing is I'm trying to build an audience and maintain or change a behavior by building that audience over time. So that's what I look at as sort of like true content marketing. Your audience is in the middle, and you as a media company or as a brand, product brand, you can monetize that audience in 10 different ways. There's direct. Direct is on the inside and indirect is on the outside. So direct is all the ways that a media company, and you mentioned some already, Geronimo, where you talk about, I'm going to do paid subscriptions once I have an audience, or I'm going to sell advertising or sponsorship, or I'm going to do in-person or virtual events, or I'm going to sell premium content packages like ebooks or books. Or maybe in some cases, you might have an initiative where you can take donations, or you're going to do affiliate revenue like New York Times does with Wirecutter. So those are six different ways on the inside that you could say, I could generate revenue. By the way, you could do that if you're a product company too, but most of the time they don't. Then you get to the outside. That's where you're looking at revenue opportunities that are traditionally content marketing. If I build an audience, I can sell more of my product widgets, if you will. I can sell more if I'm a manufacturer, or I can sell more if I'm a retailer or Amazon or whatever the case is. Or maybe you want to sell more services, so you're going to look at that. Or traditionally, content marketing was born out of loyalty. So if you're John Deere and you create a magazine in 1897 called the Furrow Magazine, the reason why you send a magazine every month to John Deere owners is because you believe that your hypothesis is that more people will buy John Deere equipment. And of course, that's why the magazine is still going on today. Or if you're talking about Walmart or Mazda or car company, they all have magazines out. Or maybe your idea is our marketing hypothesis is if we send this email newsletter that our customers are going to be better customers, meaning they'll buy more, or they'll stay longer, or they'll talk more affectionately about our brand. Something like, TD Ameritrade has Think Money magazine that goes out to their traders, and they send that out to people that trade stocks and derivatives, and they find that if people engage in that content on a regular basis, they actually trade more, five times more in this particular case study. So those are 10 different ways that you can look at revenue generation. All the creators that you talked about, where you've got Apple and Spotify creating all these new creator programs, everyone is now on the side of the content creator. Everyone wants to get the influencers because they don't want to create the content themselves. And so they say, we can leverage all these content creators. Let's just bring them on our platform. So you're seeing all these creator economy, if you will, revenue opportunities, which are all fine and anyone can use them. But you got to remember, you are... I would call that more like a side gig. You are like the Uber driver for Uber. So if you're working for Spotify and Apple, or you're working for Substack, or you're working for somebody else, and you're trying to build their platform, and you get your little cut of it, and then the rest goes to whatever the big platform is, which, by the way, some people want. That might be fine for some people, but I want to just go out there. And that's why when we talk to either brands or content creators, I just get worried. And I'm like, you don't want to put all your eggs in the platform's basket, because let's say that you'd mentioned YouTube. If you have 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, who owns those subscribers? You don't own them. YouTube owns them. You've helped YouTube. Now, that's not to say that maybe you can monetize that through advertising, but YouTube can make a decision any day and say, oh, I'm going to kick you off the platform. Or even though somebody subscribes to your channel, I don't have to show that content. We've seen how easily over the past couple of years that people can get blackballed out of any community, if you will, and all those algorithms constantly change. So all I would say is, you just got to be really careful if you put all your eggs on these other platform baskets. And that's why I'm still a huge fan of email. If you said, Joe, if you had to put all your eggs into one basket and you had to, what would it be? It'd probably be first, it would be email. And second would be podcasts, because that's where you have the most control over your content distribution. That might change in the future, but right now, that's where we're at.
Yeah, and that was my next question, because I've seen this trend in the last year, especially, where brands and companies have like awakened in this data ownership of the audiences, no, which is what you were saying about YouTube, especially in Facebook/Instagram and in Google/YouTube. And we've seen changes in the algorithm that calculates how much these tech companies are paying the creators. And with the changes in Facebook algorithms 2 or 3 years ago, many publishers were like having 1/3 of the revenue they were having a month earlier, these changes. And that, I think, get the idea to many creators that they did not have the control, which they didn't, but they didn't have realized before, I think, in that perspective. And I think that's why direct marketing has a comeback recently, because is the integration of a data strategy in some companies and implementing CRMs, which is also the first time I hear the word CRM was back in the early 2000s, but it was in a very different way that now is imagined with technology, I think. But the main ingredient of the actual CRM word today, I think it's a place where all the data is centralized, and we can exploit it to have a better decision making, no? And I want to connect that with this idea of going back to basics, to the direct marketing model, and having the control of your client or your audience, and not depending so much in these tech giants that we don't know for how long we are going to be able to do the things we are doing, which they are great and they work, of course, but someday things can change, and we don't want to base our revenue strategy or sales of a company in a third party and technology, no? So mail marketing in that sense has been also a huge comeback. In the last 2 years, in a lot of conversations in Unbranded and with other peers in the industry, I think mail marketing has come into conversation in a very big way. What will be your best tips for a CMO or a brand manager that thinks that it's like old school, is not about this hype of TikTok or Clubhouse or these other things that we were saying? Sometimes nerd marketing seems like something old and old-fashioned and that not work as good as other. But the data says that conversion rate in mail marketing to drive sales in many industries and efforts has better conversion rates than other digital media. So what will be your best tips to to start or renew a mail marketing strategy for a big brand?
I think it's one of the biggest opportunities I've ever seen, because if you just look at what's happened, so, you know, if you look at what's coming through the post right now, you're not getting anything of substance. All the magazines, the publisher magazines, a lot of those have gone out of business, so you're not getting them anymore. And all the custom products have gone, so nobody's using that. But the last I've seen, most people still get mail. And are you saying that, oh, I want to take our resources and I'm going to put, let's just use Facebook because Facebook is more universal. I want to send out and do a regular program on Facebook and do a regular, let's say, video program and get maybe, if I'm lucky, 1% organic reach. Maybe you get 1%. Or do you want to go and target an audience that you know exactly where they live and you have a perfect control over sending them something? And by the way, you're going to send something of amazing value that you know they're going to get. And you can see and just make sure that your calls to action are in order so that you can track some of these things. I think it's one of the greatest. I mean, if I had a deal right now, I'd be looking at doing a print magazine because there's no competition. I'm competing with everybody on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok, but I've got no competition over here in mail. So that's why. And by the way, we've already seen this happen. If you remember 5, 6, 7 years ago, nobody was talking about email, right? Everyone was going to social. What's happened the last 2 years? Everyone's going into email. So we're seeing everything into email and everything into print, and it's completely old school. And I guess to answer your question, if I was talking to the chief marketing officer, I said, what do you want? You want something? You want to look like the coolest CMO ever and get fired? Or do you want to keep your job and look like you're old school? Old school is new school. I mean, And even look at the data, even when you're targeting Generation Z, there's a heavy amount of Generation Z that actually reads print, believe it or not. So back to your point, Geronimo, about data, let's look at the data and not go with what our gut feels is the right decision. And if we look at the data, we will see that people are opening emails, that they're actually checking their mail, that they still love to engage in print, that they don't want to be on their phones all the time, but there's not a really good choice of something to engage with in print. Well, let's give them something amazing in print so that they can actually spend some time there. So that's, I would be looking at top of the hierarchy. Because then again, if you go to YouTube and you go to Facebook and you go to TikTok, you need a secondary strategy for first party data. First party data is critical. You can't just do a whole program and leave that over to the platforms to keep all the spoils. You have to come back and say, we need that first party data, which, by the way, if you're looking at all the privacy regulations and all, no more third party cookies and everything, this is a boom for email again. So everybody's talking about, oh, we need a really good email program. But a lot of people were ahead of the game a couple years ago before all this happened.
When you were talking about the old school is the new school, there's something important here, and it's how we we are getting to understand new things about email thanks to the data and thanks to what we can track. So even if it's an old school platform, if we can call so, it's not as old as we used to think about it, because now we know the power of the subject. Now we know the power of how directly you need to go to your call to action to make sure that you will be only 2 clicks away from the conversion. You need to understand what's going to be the best image for that email. So I think what really happened is the email is the same channel, but the way we use the email is now way more intelligent than it used to be. Because now, like you were saying, you need to make sure that your email will be read before the other 25 emails that will get to that person in that same moment. Even the emails that they don't want to receive. So you need to get out of that clutter and be the first mail they want to open and be the first mail they want to click and they want to go and find something that is very interesting for them. So I think even if we talk about email as something old school, that let's not forget that the data that we have right now, it's also very powerful for us to understand the email strategy and be sure that if you are not good enough in writing the subject, if you're not good enough in having a decision of what you want to share with your audience, the email is not going to work. So it's not about, let's not forget the power of the channel and the power of what's in the channel, what's the message of that channel. So just wanted to add that, because for me, it has been one of the most overwhelming and inspiring things about the media that we used to think that it was old, and now we realize it's not old. It's just the way you use it, that it could be the best performing media.
We have this question over and over asked through social media from Branded and different other guests here. How to monetize a podcast, which is an upcoming format and that has a different model at the end if you compare it to YouTube or YouTubers, which is a revenue share model with the platform and advertisers. YouTube, as you already explained in your book, you build an audience and then you can monetize that audience with a revenue share with this programmatic advertising platform that Google has created. No, but in audio, the things are different. As you know, Spotify or Apple does not have that total control of the content of the audio files. They are not hosting the content audio files in their servers. Normally a podcaster is doing it. So I think that changes a lot of things because they don't have control of the ad insertion. So they don't own the content and they cannot put these advertisers' messaging in the content. So they cannot have this revenue model. And that's why they are trying to figure out if subscription or other things will work for the content creators and the platform. So what are your ideas about monetizing this upcoming format of podcast?
Yeah, I'm not a fan of any of the subscription platforms, and I'm not a fan of deferring sales to some other organization, because a media company would never do that. It would never say, oh, okay, we're building this podcast and then let's let somebody else insert ads into it. So what I want to do is I want to control that process. So if I build an audience that I can actually sell sponsorships in, I'm going to sell them myself, or I'm going to hire a team to do that and insert that. So if you look at how we monetize, so we have This Old Marketing Podcast. We started in 2013 with Content Marketing Institute. We sold generally one sponsorship per episode. We had one promo piece that we would support something else in. So that meant that we would be sending people to an event. We would have a coupon code. We would want them to download a report, something like that. Maybe it was consulting services. So we were selling products and services on the one end. So they were monetizing that way. We were also monetizing it through sponsorship. So we were doing it that way. And that's absolutely the best way to do it. Or you could just say, we're going to use this as a marketing vehicle for everything else. If you look at Entrepreneurs on Fire from John Lee Dumas, he has a huge affiliate program that he runs through his podcast. And he'll say it at the end. He's like, this podcast is supported through a lot of partners. Here's all the links to go to. And he makes millions of dollars going through that. And he's very successful. So I would just say, you could look at all kinds of revenue opportunities, the same 10 that we talked about before, you can leverage in a podcast, but you don't want to give up control over that process. If you give up control over that process to somebody else, like a YouTuber does, by just saying, okay, here's my videos, and you just monetize those, I don't think you're thinking big enough. I think you're thinking very small, that this is just side hustle revenue that you can get for a short period of time, instead of thinking about building an audience for the long term and monetizing that audience over a long period of time.
So it's about diversify, no? Also in terms of your revenue streams and having this merchandising, selling a book, having these events, sponsorships, etc., what will give you the interesting revenue model and business model for a content creator.
And that's not even, you're right. That's not even just for a creator. That's for any brand, because I would look at it, your content marketing, just like a financial portfolio. So if you said, okay, here's my content marketing program, I'm going to put all my money into one stock. Well, that's very risky. Why would you do that? So what I want to do is I want to put it in a bunch of mutual funds, and I want to put a little bit in cryptocurrency and have a little gold and a little bond, right? And we have a nice financial portfolio. That's the same thing we want to do for our content marketing initiative and say, oh, okay, we're selling. Cleveland Clinic in the United States does this really well, talking about when they have their blog program, Health Essentials. So they, with Health Essentials, they actually sell sponsorship. They have affiliate programs. They run content syndication programs through that. And they also drive more the content marketing effort. They drive more patients into the hospital as well. So that program pays for itself in revenue before you even get to, is it driving more patients into the hospital? So I think these are the types of programs we have to think about, well diversified. You want one core channel, but you're going to diversify that in many ways from a revenue standpoint.
Just to finalize this conversation, first of all, thank you for your time. And don't want to skip the opportunity to share with the people who hear us that you do a lot of non-profitable work. And in marketing, everything we do is really connected to the result, which is conversion. And if you go to the higher funnel or lower funnel, whatever you want to get, it will be a conversion or a goal. But when you work in a non-profitable organization or a non-profitable project, what you want to build, it's more about kind of like the higher side of the funnel. But what do you have learned from the both sides of the equations in the non-profitable world and the marketing world that will drive a strategy that we know nowadays that these concepts will be living together more than ever, because we need brands with purpose. We need to work towards that.
No, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I've been working on our effort. Our effort is Orange Effect Foundation Speech Therapy for Kids, and we've been working on it forever. And we've tried to integrate that into every business that we've run, because I think people want to be associated with something that stands for something, right? And you were just mentioning that. So if I'm doing if we go back to marketing and I'm looking at my mission statement, I would really think that it should have some larger purpose established with it, if you can possibly do that. I think it's a lot easier for the Patagonias of the world or the JetBlues of the world to market than it is for some company that doesn't stand for anything. It's very, very difficult if you're just kind of in the middle. So that's where we talk about you have to have a point of view. So if you're targeting all, it's very, I don't know how a brand does it that targets basically all consumers. If you target everyone, you're targeting no one. Same with your content. If your content is for everybody, it's for nobody. So I want to be really focused on being great at one thing and saying it's okay for these other people not to be associated with that. And that's where your nonprofit initiative, your purposeful initiatives come into grow. So I would absolutely link that up with your marketing and have it be one and the same.
Man, that's the perfect quote. So we can finish this chapter. Once again, thank you for your time. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to have you here to hear everything and all the amazing ideas that you brought to the conversation. And I really hope to get to know you with a beer in hand, watching a Cleveland Browns game, of course. And thank you very much. We really appreciate it. And everyone who's hearing, todos los que están escuchando este capítulo, si quieren saber más, por favor, busquen a Joe Pulizzi en su Instagram como @JoePulizzi en LinkedIn y sigan de cerca su trabajo, que es espectacular. Y si les gustó este capítulo, síganos en @UnbrandedPodcast. Déjenos sus comentarios, taguenos a Jero, a mí, a Bernardo, a Joe cuando escuchen este episodio. Y muchas gracias por uno más. Y nos vemos a la siguiente. Muchas gracias.
Nice having you here, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
Unbranded, un espacio para compartir lo mejor del marketing y aprender de los expertos.